Chapter 1. Fibres in the Cave. The Origins of Weaving. The First Weavers. With the tie of the sacrificial meal, the amulet, with the thread of life, the colourful, whose knot is the truth, with that I bind your heart and spirit. What is your heart should be mine. What is my heart should be thine. Vedic Mantra. When Eliso Kvavadze bent to the eyepiece of a microscope, what she expected to see was Neolithic pollen. As a botanist at the Georgian National Academy of Sciences, this was her stock in trade. Microscopic traces of ancient plant life scraped from the floor of a remote cave would, she hoped, reveal information about the changing climate of the ancient world. Different trees and plants flourished during ice ages and more temperate times, so pollen samples from different species are an eloquent witness to the weather of their time. On this particular day in 2009, however, the minute pollen grains on the slide were rudely thrust from the limelight by something extraordinary lying beside them. The oldest fibres known to have been used and produced by humans. The cave that Kvavadze and a team of Georgian, Israeli and American researchers was investigating is known as Dzudzwana. It bores into the Caucasus Mountains in the western part of the Republic of Georgia. To the casual eye, this cave might not seem so remarkable. Its puckered mouth, the shape of a letter D lying on its back, is around 560 meters above current sea level, and from this opening, the cave squirms back and down into solid rock. Radiocarbon dating suggests that modern humans first pressed timid, wandering feet into its floor as early as 34,500 years ago. Although they were there for around 20 millennia, the people of Dzudzwana trod lightly and left relatively little behind. We do know that these first weavers were efficient, unfussy hunters. From bones scattered through the cave floor, the Paleolithic inhabitants seem to have favoured mountain goat and later bison, but they also brought down aurochs, pine marten, wild boar and even wolves. We know too that they made a variety of tools, scrapers and cruelly sharp blades made from stone and obsidian, and wore decorative pendants. So far, so typical, but Kvavadze's discovery showed that they were creating fibres from plants too, a fiddly undertaking at the best of times, and using a technology previously believed to be much more recent. This undercuts long-held assumptions about our early ancestors, stretches the history of fabric back much further than many had ever imagined, and gives us a fuller, richer picture of the lives lived by some of our early ancestors. New threads. Brother, when you have brought me the woven flax, who will dye it for me? Who will dye it for me? That flax, who will dye it for me? Sumerian Love Song, 1750 BC. The threads that Kvavadze found are invisible to the naked eye, and the objects they were part of disintegrated long ago. Nevertheless, these fibres do allow the curious to get some intriguing glimpses of their secrets. One thing they reveal is that the people who made them were industrious. Well over 1,000 microscopic fibres were found in the clay that had slowly accumulated on the floor of the Dzudzwana cave over time, representing many hours of work, from collecting the flax to weaving threads together to create whatever it was that they were creating. In the oldest layer, there were nearly 500 fibres. A more recent one, dating from 19,000 to 23,000 years before present, YBP, contained 787. The means of creating these fibres must have been carefully handed down from one generation to the next. The secrets of their manufacture may have been taught using the light at the mouth of the very cave in which they were found. The threads were made from bast, flexible fibers made from the innards of plants, which requires sophisticated processing. Some of the fibers had been spun, and some were simply twisted. In a paper announcing their discovery, Kravadze and her team noted with some astonishment that several samples appeared to be 2-ply S twisted in a relatively complex pattern. A plied yarn is one that is made from 2 or more threads, twisted together in the opposite direction to that in which they were spun. What this means practically, when it is done well with just the right amount of twist, is that the finished yarn is balanced and easier to work with. It will neither unravel nor twist up on itself. In short, if these samples are indeed 2-ply S twisted, then they indicate an astonishing level of mastery. More confounding still was that many of the fibers appeared to have been dyed, probably using colorants from plants. And just as with the twisted samples, the range of colors found suggests that the Dzudzuana weavers were very good at it. Although the majority of the threads were gray, black, and turquoise, there were also yellow, red, blue-violet, green, khaki, and even pink ones, suggesting a sophisticated knowledge and use of local dye plants and other colorants. The 2 older layers, which represent the period from around 32,000 YBP to 19,000 YBP, contained the most dyed fibers. Of the 488 found in the oldest layer, 58 were dyed. Of the 787 fibers found in the next oldest, 38 were dyed. Although the variety of colors was greater, it was here that the pink thread was found. Researchers examining the cave also discovered the remains of moth larvae commonly found on decaying textiles, fungus that grows on clothes, and evidence of hair from a goat species. The bast fibers may therefore have been used to make thread to sew together animal hides for clothing. Other probable uses include making string or cords for hafting tools or basket weaving. Ofer Bar Yosef, an Israeli archaeologist who worked closely with Kravadze, wondered if all those thousands of years ago, the cave's inhabitants had woven the fibers together in a manner not dissimilar to macrame. Elizabeth Wayland Barber, an expert in prehistoric textiles, argues that the simple fabrication of string was a powerful technology, revolutionizing what they could do. You can tie things up in packages so you can carry more. You can put out nets and snares to catch more game so you can eat better. Wither fur. Clothes make the man. English proverb, 15th century. Clothing is thought by anthropologists to perform 2 important functions in human society. The first is display. But humans are perfectly capable of visually distinguishing themselves without clothes, using everything from tattoos to jewelry to body piercings and adaptations. Many peoples, including the 5th century Huns who so terrified the Romans, bandaged children's skulls to flatten them, making the heads of adults sweep backwards and up, for example. Once humans were wearing clothes, they would have used them to display their status, but that doesn't seem like a wholly convincing reason for them to have been adopted in the first place. A more practical explanation for clothing is to protect against cold. Humans are ill-adapted for living outside the warm climates in which they first evolved. Compared to many other mammals, even other primates, our defenses against cooler temperatures are inefficient. We lack brown fat, for example, which can readily be metabolized to provide heat, a stratagem deployed by many of our genetically closest relations. But perhaps our most obvious weakness in this area is our relative hairlessness. Rabbits reach their cold limit at around minus 45 degrees Celsius. Without their fur, it would only be around 0 degrees. An unclothed human begins to feel chilly at a balmy 27 degrees. Our core body temperature is around 37 degrees. If it falls below 35 degrees, hypothermia sets in, and death would be expected once it drops to 29 degrees. Even mild hypothermia is problematic. A pamphlet produced by the British Army warns soldiers that it can make sufferers behave irrationally, and that the risks are exacerbated by exhaustion or malnourishment. If being hairless is so disadvantageous to our species, when and why did we become the naked ape? Humans are the odd mammals out in this regard. Others, such as elephants and whales, have had special evolutionary reasons for losing their hair. To explain this oddity, some have theorized that we perhaps went through a semi-aquatic phase. The slight webbing between our fingers, the theory goes, is one vestigial link to this previous way of life, and our hairlessness another. A second theory is that our lack of hair kept us cooler when we swapped our shaded forest habitat for a hotter savanna one. But naked skin actually absorbs more energy in the heat of the day and loses it more rapidly when it's cold, making it the worst of both worlds when it comes to heat management. A more recent theory, put forward by two British scientists in 2003, is that we lost our fur because it harbored disease-carrying parasites and because of sexual selection. To potential mates, bare, smooth, and bug-free skin would have been the equivalent of the mandrill's multicolored rump or peacock's showy plumage. Irresistible. Parasites, funnily enough, have also been exploited by scientists to work out when we began wearing clothes. Body lice feed, unsurprisingly, on human bodies, but live exclusively in clothing. Finding out when these lice evolved from their forebears, head lice, would indicate when humans began habitually wearing clothing. Going by this method, evidence suggests we only donned clothes sometime between 42,000 and 72,000 years ago, or around the time that humans began migrating out of Africa, implying that we remained naked for around 1 million years. Not all clothing has to be made of woven materials, of course. It's likely that for a very long time, people made do with draped animal pelts, and then began roughly sewing these together, although they would perhaps have used fibrous threads to do so. Ultimately, though, the advantages of using woven fabric for clothing would have become obvious. A thick fur pelt offers excellent thermal protection if someone is sitting still or lying down. But once on the move or in strong winds, this is less true, because pelts aren't shaped close to the body. The more air gets between the body and the clothing, the less effective it is at trapping an insulating layer of air close to the skin. In fact, the isolating properties of clothing decrease by half when walking briskly. Clothing also needs to be breathable, because damp clothes are also bad at keeping the wearer warm and become very heavy. Woven fabrics are more breathable than fur, and when specifically tailored to the body, also make excellent internal layers, preventing cold air from getting direct access to the skin's surface. Thus, the ability to create woven clothing would have offered material advantages to our early ancestors once they had left Africa for cooler climes. The need for effective protection from the elements would have been even more pressing then than it is now. Over the past 130,000 years, there have been several severe temperature swings, with cooler periods accompanied by strong winds. During the colder phases of the last ice age, it is estimated that the average temperature during the winters would have been below minus 20 degrees in some of the areas humans were living. These harsh conditions, together with knowledge of human physiology and the survival of many tools that are likely to have been used in the production of clothing, from scraping tools to blades and even eyed needles, are compelling evidence of clothing, even if the articles themselves are elusive. Clothing would have been one of a suite of skills, including the ability to make shelter and fire, that humans would have needed to thrive in diverse regions. From best to worsted. A modern woman sees a piece of linen, but the medieval woman saw through it to the flax fields. She smelt the reek of the retting ponds, she felt the hard rasp of the hackling, and she saw the soft sheen of the glossy flax. Dorothy Hartley, The Land of England, 1979. The threads found at Zuzuana were made from flax, the plant that is still used to make linen. It's a tall, willowy annual, its metre-high stem strewn with spear-shaped leaves and, when it flowers, an abundance of blooms, sometimes pink or purple, but more often periwinkle blue. The variety that we use now is domesticated, Linum usitatissimum. Its probable progenitor, Linum angustifolium, originally grew wild in the Mediterranean, Iran, and Iraq, and it was people in these areas naturally who were the first to use and domesticate it. The linen used by the weavers of Zuzuana was of the wild variety. The cave dwellers who wanted to make use of it would have had to go out, find and gather it. But even once a sufficient stock had been gathered, that was far from the end of the matter. Flax needs to go through a series of elaborate steps, each with its own time-worn terminology, before it can be used to make thread. Bast fibres are found in hemp, jute and ramia, as well as flax. These fibres are composed of long, thin cells strung together end to end to form strands, like tubular beads on a thread, that run from root to tip and are held together in bundles. A single stem can contain anywhere between 15 and 35 bundles, each containing up to 40 individual fibres. These are long, anywhere from 45 to 100 centimetres, narrow, around 0.0002 centimetres, soft and strong. They feel heavy and slightly silky to the touch and have a pearlescent sheen. In the plant, they are used to protect and support the channels that bring nutrients up from the roots, so they need to be tough. They are encased in the flax plant's woody central core, or xylem, and are held together by pectinous gums, waxes, and other substances. All these layers make the bundles of fibres very difficult to extract from the stems. To begin with, the flax needs to be uprooted, not cut, at the desired age. When the stalk is young and green, before the seeds develop, the fibres are very fine, perfect for delicate fabrics. Later, as the stalks turn yellow, the bast becomes coarser but also stronger, making it better suited to hard-wearing work clothes. And, at their ripest, the tough fibres can be used to make rope or string. Once uprooted, the stems are sorted according to size, and the leaves and blossoms are stripped, a process known as rippling. The plants are dried and allowed to ret, gently rot or ferment, either slowly on a roof or more quickly in the stagnant water of specially maintained ponds or rivers. This process softens and eats away the woody outer stalk, exposing the bast and making it easier to extract. Once sufficiently tenderized, the flax is dried and then scutched and heckled, beaten and combed, to remove any lingering unwanted stalk. What remains are the bast fibres, long, subtly sheened, and ready to be spun and transfigured into linen. Almost all the earliest known man-made fibres have been made using flax rather than wool. Even when only microscopic fibrous evidence remains, it is easy to tell the difference between the two. Wool is scaled, rather than smooth like bast fibres. It has far more stretch and tends to be kinky rather than straight. This mystifies archaeologists because it seems counterintuitive. sheep, even in their ancient incarnation, which would have been rather less fluffy than modern variants, flaunt their fibrous woolly coats, and their wool is very easy to turn into thread. Wool also has the advantage of easily being felted. It is unknown, incidentally, whether felt or woolen cloth was made first, but both are likely to have originated in Central Asia. Bast fibres, on the other hand, are tricky to extract and work with, even when you know they are there. But they do have advantages. They are long staple fibres and are lighter and more breathable, better for those in hotter climates and when doing a lot of physical activity. Beyond Zuzuana. How are we to imagine a loom, which even in its simple form is a rather complicated instrument, among people who don't even know metal? Jakob Messekommer, 1913. Archaeology has traditionally had a fundamental bias against fabric. Fabrics are, after all, highly perishable, withering away within months or years, and only rarely leaving traces behind for those coming millennia later to find. Archaeologists, predominantly male, gave ancient ages names like iron and bronze rather than pottery or flax. This implies that metal objects were the principal features of these times, when they are simply often the most visible and long-lasting remnants. Technologies using perishable materials, such as wood and textiles, may well have been more pivotal in the daily lives of the people who lived through them, but evidence of their existence has, for the most part, been absorbed back into the earth. There are exceptions, of course. As with the fibres in the Zuzuana cave, traces can and do survive, usually thanks to an unusual climate, freezing, damp, anaerobic conditions, or extremely dry ones. The climate in Egypt, for example, is ideal for preserving all manner of usually perishable things, and we subsequently know far more about ancient Egyptian textiles than those from most other regions. As archaeology has matured and diversified, scholars have increasingly looked for, and found, evidence of fine, complex textiles, stretching further back than anyone would have guessed. Their beauty, and the skill needed to make them, suggest a very different image of our earliest forebears than the club-wielding, simple-minded thugs of popular imagination. The objects that most commonly survive, and from which archaeologists and anthropologists infer larger-scale textile production, are the tools that were used to make them. Spindle whirls, small weights often made of stone or clay, punctured with a small hole so that they can be jammed onto the end of a spindle, are found in abundance at many sites. They make it easier to draft and twist the fibres, and help apply the force of the twist evenly along the length of the thread being worked upon. And, although they are so simple, whirls can help reveal the kinds of fibres being worked and the desired properties of the finished product. Heavier ones are better suited to sturdier, raw materials. Thicker threads made from long staple fibres, such as flax. While, conversely, if you are making particularly fine thread from short stapled fibres like cotton, then you would use a smaller, lighter whirl. An experienced spinner can use a simple spindle and whirl to superlative effect. Indian hand spinners were said to be able to stretch a single pound of cotton into gossamer-thin thread over 200 miles long. Our modern machinery isn't capable of such dexterity. Looms also leave some traces. They were used to make larger pieces of textile and to help keep threads that were soft and floppy taut. Weaving at its heart involves two elements, the first set of threads, or weft, being inserted through a second fixed set, the warp. The purpose of a loom is to hold the warp in place, leaving hands free to weave the weft. These words, incidentally, spring from the same source. Like spindles and whirls, looms come in different forms, but were presumably often made of wood, so were unlikely to survive. We do know they existed, though. A depiction of a ground loom, one stretched between pegs set into the ground, was found in a dish placed in a woman's grave during the early 4th millennium BC at Bidari in Upper Egypt. Another variety is called the weighted or warp-weighted loom. This consists of a tall vertical frame with a high horizontal crossbar, from which the warp threads hang and are held taut by little weights attached to their lower ends. Use of this kind of loom has been posited at Neolithic and Bronze Age sites all over Europe and Asia Minor. One is thought to have been used at Chertovy Vorota, Devil's Gate, a cave in what is now Russia, around 30 kilometers from the Sea of Japan, that was inhabited around 6,000 years ago. When the site was excavated in the 1970s, it was found to have contained some kind of wooden structure. Built in the centre of the cave and containing a veritable Neolithic trove of shells, bones, human and animal, and potsherds. Carbonised fragments of textiles were found too, although spindle whorls were absent, leading researchers to assume that the threads were made painstakingly, entirely by hand, and woven on a warp-weighted loom. More concrete remains were discovered in a house in Troy, dating back to the early Bronze Age. The house had been consumed by a fire so quickly that the warp weights were found in a perfect row where they had fallen. Scattered around them were 200 or so tiny, shimmering golden beads that were likely being woven steadily into the cloth before the fire broke out. Other smaller objects may speak of textile production too. Eyed needles, often made from bone, and found at sites stretching from Western Europe to Siberia and Northern China, were not necessarily used to make clothes, still less woven ones. They could also have been used to make tents or fishing nets, for example. But the needles found do seem to correlate to colder regions and periods when the need for fitted, secure clothing would have been keenest. The oldest, found in Russia, is around 35,000 years old. Small, pierced circular pieces of stone and bone, occasionally decorated, have been found, which may have originally functioned as buttons. A nice piece of corroboration for this theory has been found at an Upper Paleolithic site in France called Montastruc, where an engraved human figure was found with a row of neat circles down its front, from chest to mid-thigh. One of the first indications of just how far back the threads of fabric production reach came in 1875. A group of Russian noblemen officers, stationed in Crimea near some ancient mounds known as the Seven Brothers, began digging in and around the area in the hopes of finding treasure. Unlike the majority of those who greedily prod the earth seeking easy wealth, the nobles struck rich. The prehistoric tombs contained gold, marble sculptures, and, most astonishing of all, beautifully complex ancient textiles, desiccated and preserved by the dry air. The settlement to which these tombs belonged was a Greek one, called Panticapaion, founded in the 6th century BC, later damaged by an earthquake, and finally snuffed out by a Hun invasion in the 4th century AD. The community had clearly contained skilled weavers. One great textile, which the nobles found draped over a wooden sarcophagus, was made up of around a dozen friezes, mythological, animal, and geometric, with floral borders in a chromatic triumvirate of buff, red, and black. The tomb in which it was found had been filled and sealed up in the 4th century BC, but the cloth had been carefully repaired, and so was probably much older. Other tombs contain textiles depicting birds, stags, and mounted men in a panoply of styles and colours. More evidence of early fabric production followed. Before the discovery at Zuzwana, the oldest evidence of known fabric dated back 28,000 years. It was of a strangely ghostly, indirect kind. What was found at a site in the Czech Republic, called Dolní Vistanice, wasn't fabric itself, but the imprint some fibres had left in clay fragments, both raw and fired. These impressions, however, are sufficient to indicate that these weavers too had well-honed skills. The traces in the clay revealed multiple variations of two-ply and braided three-strand cords, along with a multitude of woven fabrics. More was to follow. During the mid-19th century, some Neolithic fragments of brocaded fabric, complete with a fringed border, were unearthed from some Swiss lake dwellings dating back to 3000 BC. The village also contained flax in all stages of preparation, from seed to unworked stalks. In the 1920s, two archaeologists, Gertrude Catton Thompson and Eleanor Gardner, conducted the first survey of Fayum, a site in Egypt which yielded a scrap of coarse linen together with a small cooking pot and a fish vertebra. On the 12th of September 1940, a small dog called Robot and his human companions, four French children, discovered a hole under the roots of a storm-felled tree. Beneath it was the Lascaux Cave Complex, the walls of which were covered with a painted, heaving cavalcade of oxen, horses, aurochs and stags, which date back to around 15,000 BC. While these paintings have become famous and act as a kind of shorthand for the sophistication of our early ancestors, this wasn't the only craft Lascaux's inhabitants were engaged in. One night in 1953, Abbé Glory, a French prehistorian, idly picked up what he took to be a piece of rubble on the floor of the Lascaux cave. The rubble turned out to be a solidified lump of clay and calcite, and it unexpectedly broke open, like a Fabergé egg in his palm. Inside was a perfectly preserved imprint of a long piece of Paleolithic cord. Around 30 centimetres of this same imprinted cord has since been discovered, revealing it to be made of two-plied strands of some kind of vegetable fibre, neatly S-twisted together. Intriguingly, a 2013 discovery in southeast France has led to tentative suggestions that Homo sapiens may not have been the first species to have made string. A tiny sliver of twisted fibres, just 0.7 millimetres long, was found in a site occupied by Neanderthals 90,000 years ago, well before sapiens arrived in Europe. Çatalhöyük, a UNESCO heritage site in what is now central Turkey, was once a sophisticated Neolithic settlement occupied from around 7,400 BC to 6,200 BC. This period saw the move from a hunter-gatherer lifestyle to a more settled one, and there are signs that the occupiers were proud of their new homes. The rectangular mud-brick structures contained hearths and sleeping platforms, were entered through holes in the roof rather than doors in walls, and were painted with geometric designs in crimson and burnt orange using pigments including ochres and cinnabar. Adding to this embarrassment of archaeological riches, during a dig in 1961, a dark, shallow pit in the corner of one of the dwellings was found to contain the carbonized remains of humans and fabrics, dating to the beginning of the 6th millennium BC. The excavation was problematic. Climatic conditions made the recovery of the textiles a trying business. Hans Helbeck, the archaeologist who worked on the site, complained. If one attempted to expose the whole burial in a proper fashion, the surface would dry up immediately in the scorching heat, and the textile remains would turn into powder and be carried away by the persistent wind. But the care he took was rewarded. The scattered remains of around 7 or 8 bodies, including those of several children, were jumbled together, some charred, others with withered muscles still attached. Intriguingly, traces of textiles lay among the bones. Some had been reduced to dust or scant hanks of thread, but larger pieces remained intact. It appeared as if the bodies, after being dismembered, had been carefully encased in fabric and parceled up with string. Some larger limbs were wrapped separately, others bundled with smaller bones. One half of a lower jaw was even found to have been painstakingly immured in several layers. The weaving techniques found at Catalhoyuk varied enormously. Some pieces were coarse, others fine. Some were of plain warp-weft pattern, while in others the thicknesses and spacing differed. All the textiles, with the exception of the string, were made with animal fibre, probably wool, and they made a great impression on Helbeck. All these fabrics, he wrote, display a technical skill which cannot but surprise the observer, considering their great age, at least 8,500 years. Quite apart from wondering when humans began to weave, we must also ask how. It may have started with basketry using tender leaves and stems, through to matting, netting, and cordage, each step getting the proto-weavers closer to creating flexible lengths of cloth. Remains from these early millennia are scant. New archaeological finds pose as many questions as they provide answers. Early textiles, woven from fibres extracted from plants or plucked from sheep or goats, were essential survival tools for our earliest ancestors, more vital than weapons. Fabrics could provide shelter, warmth, and later visible status. They also proved an outlet for one of humanity's most compelling qualities, creativity. The shimmering cloth being made in the burnt Trojan home, and the objects that the Dzudzwana fibres were part of are lost to us. We will never be able to see them, or understand what they meant to their makers. What we can be sure of, however, is that their creators put thought and care into them. Why else use golden beads and pink, grey and turquoise dyes? Even from the earliest point of their creation, fabrics have mapped the ambition and skill of their creators.